Hedy Epstein, Reel 7.
I was wondering also, you know, and this is going back to your experience in Germany after the war. You know, it seems to me that the job you did, you know, in the Nuremberg trials in particular, that perhaps you couldn't have punished yourself more, bearing in mind what had happened to your parents. And I'm wondering how much you knew about the camps and when you knew it. You know, in the war, when did it... You were saying that, you know, your protective devices that you had. Well, when did you really... When were you faced with what had happened?
I think I really didn't know about the camps, or only began to know about the camps after the war was over. And, of course, learned a great deal more when I was in Nuremberg. And I think, really... that job and many jobs after that were part of my search for my parents. Though it wasn't a conscious decision, but when I look back now, with hindsight, I think that's what I was really doing, is trying to, it was another way of trying to find my parents without actually knowing that I was doing it. And later on, I think I was consciously searching for my parents, but subconsciously took the kinds of jobs that would perhaps expose me to people who might know something. Because the first job that I had in the United States was for an organization, a Jewish organization called New Yorkers. New York Association for New Americans. And it was an organization that was bringing over displaced persons, Jewish displaced persons, from Germany to the United States. And after the initial job, which I only had for a very short time, I was transferred within the agency to another job, which then made me be the second person that these people who were brought over would meet after they arrived in the United States. They were met at the boat by somebody from the agency, and then I was the next person that they saw. And so I saw all the people that came in on every boat. And I know I would ask these people, where were you? Hoping that maybe somebody would have been in the camps in France. At that time, I didn't know yet that my parents had been sent to Auschwitz, because this was still 1948. And I worked in this agency from 48 to 1950. And I never met anybody who was in the camps where my parents were. Never met anybody that knew my parents or knew anything about it. But I also, the other thing was, I looked at people, thinking, maybe my parents are going to walk in. And of course, that didn't happen. When I was hired for this job, I was told that this is not a lifetime job because we're bringing over refugees, and at some point there will be no more, and then we are in fact already laying off some people, but we do need you right now, we need this job filled. And then in 1950, they no longer need me because there were not many people arriving anymore, and so they were cutting back on staff, and those who were there longer than I would still have kept the jobs. And so I then decided that I had really not gotten to know America. Living in New York, you don't know America. It's not New York. I mean, it's not America. And I had not really gotten to know Americans because I was mostly traveling in refugee circles. And so I said, I've been here 2 years. It's about time I find out. And I'm going to leave. I need to find a job anyway. So why not find a job someplace else? And I opened the map, closed my eyes, I put my finger down somewhere, and it turned out to be the Twin Cities of St. Paul in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I moved there. And I worked for a Jewish Family and Children's Service there, and they were not bringing over people, but people, refugees or displaced persons, had been located in, or relocated to the Twin Cities, and were coming to the agency for assistance. And so again, I was looking at people and asking for a movie. So it's still that search. And while I was working at the agency, we were contacted by an organization in New York, the United Restitution Organization. And that organization was assisting people who suffered under the Nazi regime, either personal losses or material losses, were assisting them in their claims against, their restitution claims against the German government. And they contacted the agency in Minneapolis that I worked for if they could perhaps find somebody who could help people who live in Minneapolis who have these claims, because it's too difficult to do it from New York. And so the agency director asked me if I felt I could do this, and I said, I have no idea. I need to. I don't know the laws. I don't know what the work entails. And so I said, well, why don't you send me away for information and see if you can do it? And I started doing that. And while I lived in Minneapolis, I met the man who became my husband, and he then got a job in New Jersey, so I moved to New Jersey, and contacted this agency in New York, the United Restitution Organization, saying, you know, I did this work in Minneapolis, worked with you, and now I'm here and I'm looking for a job, and I work for you, so I got a job with them. And so now I was exposed to many more people, and still the same search, looking at faces and asking people where they were. Met one woman who was in the same camp briefly where my father was, but didn't know my father, and didn't want to talk about the camp. And while I was at this agency, I became pregnant and then left. So until then, so this was really until 1956, I continued looking. And in 1956, I also received that letter, but it was later in 1956, that my parents had been deported to Auschwitz. Not sure where to go right now.
How did you react to that when you knew that? Can you remember? Was it important to know where they had been?
I was still. Then the question was, did they really get there? Did they really, you know, because some people. Then I thought about that list that I found with my father's name on it. What is there a connection, and if so, what, and if not, why not, and what does it mean, and weren't people sent to, weren't there maybe people were supposedly sent and they weren't sent, and probably they're still alive, and probably they're still somewhere, and I just haven't, waited long enough. And and then the other thing was, I was working for an agency that was filing claims against the German government, restitution claims. And I had several opportunities to file, several different claims that I could file. One was for the death of my parents, and I couldn't admit that they had died, how can I file for that? For the time that they spent in the concentration camps, so much, they paid so much for each month, for the interruption of my education. And that I was able to do without any difficulty because that was happened to me and I'm here. And so I could do that. It took me quite a bit longer to request or to file for the time they spent in the concentration camp. And ultimately, my husband pushed me. And I think he saw dollars, and I think that was his motivation to apply for that also, and I did. And when that money came, I didn't know what to do with that money because it was a pitiful amount. And even if they give me all the money in the world, it doesn't replace my parents. And my husband had knew how he wanted to spend that money and made me spend that money that way, and it still bothers me to this day how that money was spent. We bought our first car with it. And it just really has always deeply troubled me. And that car is long gone, thank goodness.
Do you accept now that your parents won't come back?
No. I mean, simply, if nothing else, by virtue of their age. My father would be 102 years old. My mother would be 97 years old. So simply by virtue of their age. But in 1980, which is 11 years ago, when I was in Auschwitz on that ramp, that's all of a sudden. There's nothing there on that ramp that could even remotely remind me of my parents. But that's when all of a sudden I realized there is just no way that they could have survived. But I think it wasn't so much the ramp, although that's when I suddenly came to that realization. I had been in the camp the better part of the day already and saw the dismal conditions. And I had also been, before that, to Dachau and to Kurs. Kurs doesn't really exist anymore. And so I just knew then I had to accept it. I don't know if it's alive, that it's not possible. I mean, that they did not survive. Interesting step at the time that I just made. I'm still having apparently some difficulties with that. I mean, that to witness filling out that application or that questionnaire last year in 1990 about information that the Russians, the Soviet Union released about people who were in Auschwitz. So I've accepted it, and there's still a lingering. I mean, I know they're not no longer alive, but it's very important, I think. You know, we have these rituals where we view the dead body, we bury the people, we go to the cemetery, we visit the grave. And I think it's a very important ritual that we do. We need to see the deceased. We need to have a place where we can go and visit. And I have never seen my parents again. There is no place where I can visit their grave. There is no one who can tell me, I saw your parents when they died. Or I know where they are buried. The only person of my entire family who went through the camps, who is buried, is my grandfather, who died, 2 months after he arrived at Gurs. And people in Gurs were buried. They were very primitive markers there. And after the war, a German Jewish organization developed that cemetery and put identical tombstones, they're rectangular tombstones, there with a Jewish or a Hebrew inscription that is says, here lies, and then the name of the person the year of the birth, the year of the death, and the community from where they came from, if that information was available. And when I was in Bruce, I visited that cemetery and found my grandfather's grave. And so there is his death. My mother also told me and that he died. So I had that plus, or she wrote to me, I should say, that he died. So I have that, plus I was able to visit the grave. And it was a very unique experience when I visited that grave. The sun was shining brightly. And as soon as I saw the grave, the clouds covered the sun and remained that way the entire time that I was there. And there were approximately 1,250 graves in that cemetery. And I visited each and every grave because I don't know if all of them are ever going to be visited. And I felt each one should have at least one visitor once. And so I spent a whole day there. And before I left, I went back to my grandfather's grave one more time. And then when I finally left, the clouds disappeared and the sun. I'm a really tactile person, and when I found my grandfather's grave, I sort of ran my fingers over the grave, and all kinds of recollections from my childhood came back that I had not thought about in many, many years. Like, I remember my grandfather used to be able to wiggle his ears, and I used to ask him to do that. And he wore a pocket watch in his vest. And it had a lid on it. And when I was little, he used to have me sit on his lap and ask me to blow on the lid. And then when I blow on the lid would open up. And I knew then that that's not what makes the lid open up. But it was a game we played again and again and again. I remembered when he lived with us, every morning he had two soft-boiled eggs. And I used to stand next to him and watch him cut with a knife the top of the egg. And then he would give me the top of the egg. And that was the best part of the egg that I ever ate. When I ate a soft-boiled egg and cut mine off, it wasn't as good as his. And so things like that were flooding my mind while I was there. And the camp is in such a beautiful setting. In the distance, you see the snow-capped mountain, Pyrenean mountains. And I'm thinking, you know, here people were leading such miserable lives, waiting to be sent off to their death in such a beautiful setting. Two very mystical things happened, and I'm not a mystical person. I'd like to think of myself as a pragmatist with both feet solidly on the ground. When I first got to Gurs, prior to going there, I had written to this German Jewish organization, asking when can one visit, are there certain hours, is it open or is it closed, who has the key? And they wrote back that it's open at all times and there's no key because it's open and you can go anytime. And I get there and there is a fence all around the camp with a gate, and the gate has a chain with a padlock on it and it's closed. Who has the key? And the gate was only probably waist high, and I could have very easily climbed over it, but I couldn't do that because this is almost, to me, was like a holy place, and you don't do that. It desecrates this. And so I turned away with my back towards the gate, and this camp is on the outskirts of the village of Gurs. and there was a road, a perfectly straight road going either direction alongside the camp. And across the street was a field of something, I don't know, corn or wheat or something. And when I arrived there, there was nobody there. And I, you know, I get see this gate is closed. And so I turn around, like, I'm going to say to the road, you know, what do I do? Who has the key? And there's this man standing there. And where did he come from? I mean, he wasn't there before. There was no car or bicycle or anything. And he was shaking, visibly shaking, and tears streaming down his face. And so I wanted to communicate with him. I wanted, you know, who are you? Why are you here? We can't get in. Do you know how to get in? And so I'm in France, so I ask him, parlez-vous français? And he shakes his head, indicating no. And so I said to him, do you speak English? And again, he shakes his head, indicating no. Do you speak German? And I ask him that in German, and again, he indicates no. Then I ask him in Yiddish, if he speaks Yiddish, and he again indicates no. And now I've exhausted my language skills. And I could have asked him in Spanish if he spoke Spanish, but if he did, I wouldn't understand. And so I want to tell him we can't get in here. And so I go back to the gate, and I rattle the chain, and turn around, he's gone. And I don't know, did he really exist, or am I imagining it? But after I left the camp, so this will forever be a mystery to me, and if he was there, who was he, and if he wasn't there, what does this mean? After I left the camp, late much, I mean, this was at the beginning of the day, this now I'm talking about the end of the day, and I did find the person who had the key, who let me go in, was a farm lady. And when I left at the end of the day to return the key to her, I'm walking with my eyes downcast on the ground, and there were a lot of rocks and stones on the side of the road. And all of a sudden, I had the feeling that this one stone saying to me, I mean, I didn't hear voices, it was just a feeling kind of thing, pick me up, take me with you. And so I bent down, and I picked up the stone, and I dusted it off, and that's a pretty stone. And I then suddenly remembered that I had some correspondence prior to that, that the following year, in 1981, there was going to be an international gathering of Holocaust survivors in Israel. And the survivors were asked to bring stones from the area where they live, engraved with the names of their loved ones, and that those stones were going to be used for the construction of a monument in Israel in memory of those who didn't survive. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to pick up stones from the camps where I go to and bring those stones to Israel. And thought no further about this particular stone, put it and wrapped it up in tissue paper and put it in my pocketbook. About 10 weeks after I was back in the United States, and I'm talking about my experience and showing the things that I had from there, including the stone. The person that I showed it to is a person who was mildly retarded. Suddenly started to cry, and I said, well, I don't need to talk about this anymore if it's upsetting you. And she said, no, don't you know what's on this stone? And I said, what is on the stone? She said, there's a Star of David on the stone. It's not perfect, but there is. I took it afterwards to a geologist because I wanted to know, is it man-made or nature-made? And it's nature-made. I did not leave that stone in Israel. I took it with me. I collected stones from the other camps and left those there. That stone I couldn't leave. And I still have it. I can show it to you. What does it mean? By this stone, of all the famous stones,
do you still hate Germans?
I'm glad you're asking that, because that's a very important thing I need to talk about. I continued to hate the Germans across the board, with the exception of those who would have been too young at that time. I was able to make that allowance. I didn't buy any products made in Germany. I didn't want to have anything to do with anything that was German. If I met somebody in this country who was German, where were you? What did you do? I'm very aggressively asking them. In 1970, in late April, early May 1970, it became public knowledge for the first time in the United States that as part of the Vietnam War, which I had opposed vigorously since before there was an anti-Vietnam War movement, but it was learned for the first time in late April, early May 1970, that as part of this war, the United States had carpet-bombed Cambodia. And I became just really angry that we had done this. Why had we done this to this country? Why had we killed so many people needlessly? And all of a sudden, something triggered in, this triggered something in my head, and my thoughts traveled back across the ocean and back across the years, and I'm saying, if the Germans had done the kinds of things that I had done here, and I had picketed and marched and sent telegrams to my president and sent letters to my congressional representatives opposing this war, and if the Germans had done that, and nothing happened to me here, but if the Germans had done this, they would have ended up in a concentration camp. They would have lost their lives, or they would have really been severely punished. How can I condemn a whole nation for not being heroes? I don't know that I would be a hero. My life wasn't at stake. My family's life wasn't at stake. And, you know, at best, the FBI or the CIA has a record of mine, and so what? And with that, suddenly this hatred that I had carried for all too long really totally disappeared. And I was able to really verify that it truly disappeared, because earlier that year, my husband and I had planned to go back to Germany so I could show him where I grew up, and show my son where I grew up, where I went to school, etc. And when we were in Kippenheim, we were in a restaurant, and I talked to the proprietress, talked German to her, but English to my family, and she wanted to know who I was. And I was reluctant to tell her, and finally I told her who I was and who my family was. And so she said, yes, those were terrible times. And my sister's son was a prisoner of war in Russia. And I said to her, did he come back? Did he have a bad experience there? And how is he doing? And I was able to relate to her as one human being to another, a person who probably has had some bad experiences. But it also reminded me of something else that happened in 1947 when I was in Kippenheim the first time. And I suddenly realized that after I talked to this woman this way. Because in 1947, I was approached by somebody who told me, my brother is a POW in Russia. Can you do something to get him out? There's nothing I could have done. And that's what I should have said. But I was so full of hatred, and I didn't know who this man was. I said to her, I hope they've killed him. If they haven't, I hope you'll never come back alive. And so here were two similar situations, and I was responding very differently. So I knew I had overcome that hatred. And when I was in Germany in 1991, in June 1991, on my speaking tour, the one place where I spoke, and it was when I spoke about my experience at the Nuremberg trials. Afterwards, I got together with the moderator and one of the people in the audience, who was a historian who happened to have done her work for her PhD at the Document Center in Berlin, where I worked. Both of them said to me, you are much too forgiving of Germans. And I thought about it, and I said, but that's really how I am and how I want to be, and I'm glad that I'm rid of this hatred, because hatred is not only bad for the person you hate, it's very self-destructive. And it's just not a good position to be in. And so I'd much rather be accused of being too forgiving. It's a much more comfortable situation to be in. And yes, there were Germans, there are Germans today.